Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Okay, once again, what a week that was. And it's still ongoing. It's almost impossible not to talk about at least a half a dozen major developments during the week, and we're going to try to address some of those. And then at the latter part of the show, I want to talk about a decision called the Friedrichs versus California Teachers Association decision here, and the numbers on union membership that have just come out here. But first, let's look at the week that was. Well, today, what do we got? Preliminary fourth quarter U.S. gross domestic product numbers, a paltry 0.7% growth in the fourth quarter of 2015. 0.7, 0.7%, just as we predicted. And we're going to see even lower numbers possibly here the first quarter of 2016. This is part of a trend that's been occurring for 6 years now, since 2010. As I said several times on this show, we have a pattern of what I call relapses in the U.S. A relapse is not a bona fide recession, but it is a collapse in GDP near zero or slightly below zero for one quarter. We saw this in 2011, 12, 14, 15, and now once again. And it always comes at the end of the year, fourth quarter and or first quarter of the year, always in the winter, which either means there's something wrong with the statistics or we got a problem where the economy slows and then they throw something into the pot to warm it up again, and you get a little bit of a tepid recovery here in the spring and summer, second, third quarter. And then once again, slows down again, and they throw a little bit, not enough to really generate a sustained recovery, but a little bit. And what's really driving the problem with the U.S. economy now, you know, they've been talking about it's an exception to the world, global economy, which is slowing rapidly. No, it's not such an exception. It's just lagging. It's one of the last cows in the barn here. Look at what happened to durables, you know, discrete things, things that are sold in the U.S. economy, cars and so forth, durables that last 3 years or more, houses, etc. That's what's called durables. Non-durables are stuff you use up right away, like food or gasoline and so forth. Well, look at the durables numbers. In December, the largest drop since 1992, collapsed more than 5%. In 1 month, and 3.5% for all of 2015. That's a canary in the gold mine, It's not so gold anymore. It means that something's happening in the U.S. economy. Well, what's happening? Let's dig a little deeper. And business spending is declining. It's contracting. Business spending in the fourth quarter, minus 2.5%. Compared to a 9% growth in the third quarter. $86 billion spent on U.S. inventories in the third quarter, $68 billion in the fourth quarter. That's not good because you have excess inventories, which means as long as you're not working off the inventories, business is not working off its inventories, you're going to continue to get a decline in business spending on plant and equipment. And we're already seeing that because they can't get rid of their inventories. So they're going to stop and lower production. And they keep talking about jobs. Oh, jobs are the good indicator. But jobs are a lagging indicator. 3 to 6 months. What you were seeing in the fourth quarter of jobs is a reflection of economic activity last summer. What you're going to start to see in terms of jobs in the first half of this year is indication of rapidly slowing U.S. economic activity in the fourth quarter. It takes 3 to 6 months lag. So watch new job claims and so forth begin to rise here in the first half of this year, probably in the second quarter of this year. And watch GDP to come in anemic again, maybe even negative, once more in the first quarter of 2016. What do you think that's going to have on the stock market in the U.S.? Oh, it's going to have an effect for sure. Consumer spending is also slowing. Not just business spending, which is the key driver of it all, investment, but consumer spending is beginning to slow as well. Third quarter is 3.2% annual growth rate, down to 2.2% in the fourth quarter, which is always excessively high because of the holiday spending, consumer spending. So, you know, actually for a year average, consumer spending is probably about 1.5% fourth quarter growth, which is down, you know, 50% from the third quarter. Lots of numbers thrown around. I'm sorry, but the numbers are the numbers. This is what you see going on. Consumer price index, whether it's the core CPI, is falling, and the PCE, personal consumption expenditures, is stagnant. Oh, so slowing real goods and services prices are also an indicator of a slowdown deep within the system going on. The U.S. economy is slowing down, and it's occurring on this bigger picture of even more rapid global economic slowdown driven by the slowdown in China and emerging markets. Well, let's talk about China. You know, we've been talking in previous shows about China and saying China is faced with a real problem here of capital flight. The stock market is unwinding in China, and Chinese investors are trying to get the hell out. They're taking their money, selling off as fast as they can. The government is slowing the sell-off down some with all its significant controls and influences on the Chinese. But they can't stop it, you see. It's going to continue to unwind. It's about half of what it was a year, well, not even a year ago, in June 2015. You know, this Chinese stock market had run up 120%, some say 150%, and then the bubble burst last summer, and it's continued to unwind. And they've slowed it down a little bit, but they can't stop it. It's going to continue to unwind. And as it unwinds, Chinese investors sell their money, you know, try to slip it off into Hong Kong and Singapore and buy dollars. And then they take their dollars out of the country. And China's anti-corruption campaign is significantly, in part, trying to stop that, because there's a lot of corruption going on in that, and those violating of Chinese laws, trying to take the money out. That's called capital flight. And as capital flows out of China, and two weeks ago I predicted it would be about $1 trillion, and yes, they're emitting it now, it's $1 trillion. As capital flows out of China, it has a significant downward pressure on the Chinese currency, the yuan. And right now, they're keeping the yuan pegged to the dollar, but I predict they won't be able to keep that peg. There's too much downward pressure on the Chinese currency, and as the currency declines, so will the stock market. In other words, if the value of the currency falls, then those investments in terms of global currencies, dollars, in stock market and elsewhere, also decline. The yuan declines, so the value of investment declines. And remember, we got a lot of U.S. and other multinational companies over there in China, so the value of their investments declines. And they want to get out. They want to move their money out, move it around. And it means a big loss in corporate profits for those big businesses doing business in China. And there's a lot of them, you know, all from Walmart to Apple and so forth, you know, they're in China. And it's putting downward pressure on their profits, their global profits. So we've got a currency pressure and collapse already going on in China, and it will correct even further, which is being fed by the stock market collapse. In other words, you take your money out if you're a Chinese investor and you want to buy other currencies. You want to sell yuan. Well, you sell yuan, oversupply of yuan, supply and demand, simple. The price of the currency, the exchange rate of the currency the yuan declines. So the stock market is feeding the currency decline. And the currency decline then feeds the stock market. So you have this mutual feedback effect between the two. And then the Chinese economy itself, the real economy, is slowing down. And that puts more pressure on the stock market and therefore currency. And we got a three-way factor going on over there that's spiraling down in China. And the question is, can the Chinese government slow it or stop it? Well, they have $3 trillion in reserves. And what they do with those currency reserves, all the other currencies of the countries, they go in and they buy or try to buy yuan, their own currency in global markets. Well, if you're buying it, right, the demand for the currency rises, and therefore the yuan rises up a little bit. So it's this battle between China's central bank buying up its currency and investors selling the currency, trying to get their money out, capital flight. Capital flight's the indicator of that going on. And so far it's been a rocky road. You know, the investors drive it down. And central bank China pushes it back up, and they're trying to keep it within that band, but they're not going to be able to do that. I believe it's going to end up a more serious decline in the currency and in the stocks over there, and that has a contagion effect on the rest of stock markets globally, and it adds to the currency wars going on, which got another boost here last week, the currency war. What was that boost? Well, in the middle of the week, the head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, made another declaration saying, you know, looks like our big QE last year, QE meaning quantitative easing, meaning printing euros to buy up bonds, didn't work too well. You know, it went up a little bit, and then we got hammered by China and emerging markets and so forth. You know, even QE is not invincible in driving up financial asset prices, stock prices, and so forth, which is its main objective. Draghi admits, he says, hey, you know, looks like we didn't succeed too well, so we're going to probably have to do more. And let's pump even more money, more liquidity into banks and investors, shadow banks and businesses and so forth. You know, that's what they've been doing to keep their rich friends from collapsing like the rest of us. Mm-hmm. And it hasn't worked. It worked for a while, and then all these other factors in the global economy hit, you know, China and so forth. And looks like they were going to do some more. Well, Japan jumped the gun on them. Japan, which also has a big QE program, pumping money into the markets for investors. It too petered out. The QE petered out over there. And the Japanese were just waiting on what the U.S. Fed was going to do. You see, because if the Fed raises interest rates like it did in December, short-term rates, what that does is the de facto devaluation of the currencies of other countries like Japan and Europe and so forth, because the Fed raises rates, it drives up the value of the dollar. And if the dollar rises, then these other currencies correspondingly decline. So the U.S. raising interest rates and the value of the dollar is a de facto devaluation for these other countries, and they don't have to pump as much QE into their economies to drive their currency down, you see. But it looks like now the Fed is not going to raise rates any longer. They were going to do it again in March. No way. They're not going to do it in March. Because the U.S. economy is going to be even weaker than it is now, and they're not going to get all the political flack if they raise rates again. Because then they'll get blamed for this recession after the fact. So no Fed rate increase, which means no de facto devaluation for either the euro or the Japanese yen. That's why Draghi made his declaration. They were, you know, both Japan and Europe were watching last fall, watching the U.S. They didn't declare anymore because they're waiting to see what the Fed does. Okay, so the Fed raised rates a little bit, and they held off, they, Japan and Europe. But now it looks like the Fed's not going to raise rates anymore. And that means that they're moving forward, Eurozone and Japan, with more QE-like liquidity injection. You see, QE is just one form of liquidity injection. And what did Japan do? After Draghi made his declaration, we're going to move, Europe is going to move in March. Well, Draghi jumped the gun. And yesterday, surprisingly, after he had said explicitly for weeks that he was not going to generate negative interest rates. In other words, negative interest rates is a central bank policy where government rates are below zero. What does that mean, negative rates below zero? Well, what it means is that if you put your money in those government securities, you aren't going to get any interest payment back. You're going to have to pay to put your money in those securities. No, you're going to have to pay the government an interest charge to take your money that doesn't give you any return at all. Well, why do they do negative interest rates? We know we've had negative interest rates spreading in Europe for some time now. So it's not totally new, but it shows you how desperate the economic conditions are in Europe and in Japan. Well, what do negative interest rates, what are they supposed to do in theory? Well, if you got to pay to give people some your money, you're not going to plop your money into the bank and hold it there and not invest. In other words, if it costs you money to save it, you're not going to save it. What are you going to do with it? Well, the only thing you can do is invest it somewhere. It's a way of central banks trying to force businesses to invest. And you're certainly not going to invest in stocks which are declining or oil that's declining. Where are you going to invest? Well, hopefully the idea theoretically is you'll invest in real assets, you know, plant and equipment and growth and so forth. But the problem with that is why would businesses invest and expand their production when they can't sell what they've got or when the prices of what they've got are declining as well? I mean, why invest and take a loss over there? Well, central banks are trying to say that, well, you're going to take a loss if you save it and hoard it. And the businesses say, yeah, but we'll take a loss if we invest it. You know, prices are falling, demand is falling. And the question is, where are you going to take the bigger loss? Well, I think the negative interest rates will have no effect because the loss is quite minimal. You know, we're talking about tenths of a percent compared to the losses and the uncertainty that business would have in investing in real goods and assets. You see, real investment has been declining steadily for a decade now. And it's accelerating. That's why you can't get real job creation going on. You get some job creation in part-time temp, sharing gig economy, low-wage service jobs. But you don't get any real job creation, full-time, higher-paid jobs. Because real investment is declining everywhere, globally, including in the U.S. So this negative interest rate is a face-saver for the central banks. They maybe even believe it. But simple economic investment analysis will tell you that the cost of the negative rates, putting your money in, having to pay a couple tenths of a percent, is far less than the cost of investing in real assets when you can't even sell your products or you think your prices are going to continue to fall. And or the demand, in other words, the profitability is far less than the losses potentially are far greater investing in real things when prices are falling, deflation, and or the demand for your goods are falling. You know, you make money either by raising your prices or selling more. Well, both of those are going negative, slowing and going negative. Well, businesses hunkered down. They hold on to their money, their investment, you know, their liquidity, and what they have been doing is putting it in government bonds and so forth. Low, you know, it's a safety kind of a thing. Well, we got negative rates over in Japan now as well as in Europe. It's not going to work any more than QE doesn't work anymore. You know, central banks everywhere has been the play ever since 2010, right? All the capitalists in all the regions of the world have decided they're going to stimulate their economies through monetary policy by pumping up liquidity, money, pumping liquidity, you know, QE and zero rates and so forth into the economy. And the whole idea was, you know, that will stimulate in the financial assets and prices. And the rich and investors will get rich, and maybe they'll trickle down some of that excess profits from capital gains and financial assets into some real investment. So the whole idea is over subsidize the rich and their corporations, over subsidize them, and there'll be a wealth effect. In other words, they'll get so rich and recover so far and so fast that some of it is going to spill over to the rest of us. You know, that's the logic of it. You know, bail out the big guys first and foremost and more than you need, because the banks were bailed out years ago, you know, and they just kept this zero rate and QE crap going. Bail them out, overbail them out, you know, and the rest of us will maybe come along later. It may take a long time, but, you know, it's better to bail out my big friends. Ben Bernanke and his big friends in the banks. By the way, you know, Ben Bernanke's going around now getting rich. Everywhere he goes, he speaks, gives a speech to these business groups. $250,000 fee he makes. $250,000. And then he writes these books that the corporations buy up in large volumes, and he makes money there. You know, they give it to their managers. So that's how they reward their friends, you see. Ronald Reagan, when he left, they rewarded him nicely. He gave one speech, one 10-minute speech, made $6 million as soon as he left office. It was so egregious that they had to schedule the speech in Tokyo to avoid the press, and the press hardly picked it up here. Well, that's how they, you know, revolving doors. That's how we do corruption in the U.S. You know, it's perfectly legal. It's not like third world countries where corruption is obvious from the beginning. No, no. You know, we keep our hands clean, sometimes not, while you're in office, and then you get rewarded nicely from your friends when you leave. That's the American way of corruption. Okay, so the central banks have been doing the bidding of the bankers and the financial elite who still run the show, notwithstanding the crash that they caused, still run the show politically. I mean, look at Hillary. Hillary Clinton, as Bernie Sanders has pointed out, Hillary Clinton, you know, gives three speeches a couple years ago, three speeches, and makes $768,000 for three speeches. And who knows how many speeches ever since then, okay, been going on. So, you know, that's how it works. That's how it works. So we got this currency war going on now, to return to Japan and the ECB, Europe. And each one now, that's clear, the U.S. is not raising short-term interest rates. Now they got to devalue, and, you know, they just increase what's going on with, you know, QE or QE-like measures to, like, negative interest rates to generate liquidity into the system, you see. Okay, so that's a big thing. Currency wars are ratcheting up even further now, and I think this currency war is going to have an impact on China. China's going to, they've already joined the currency war, you know, even within the band that their currency can fluctuate. They pushed it all the way to the end of the band here last August, and then after China's currency became part of the IMF global currency, it looked like they were pushing it even further, devaluation, and that caused a lot of the problems. All right, so another topic here is all this talk amongst economists, especially business economists and the business press, of, gee, it looks like collapsing stocks and collapsing oil prices are highly correlated. In other words, they're both falling. question is, what's driving what? Is the decline in stocks driving the decline in oil, or vice versa? You know, they're trying to understand this, and they don't understand this. Well, it's very simple. You know, if you raise interest rates, you're raising the value of the dollar. And because oil is mostly traded in the dollar, in terms of dollars, right? If dollars are rising, oil prices, which are a financial asset and security, are going to decline. So rising dollar, declining oil. And the dollar has been rising, you see, because of long-term interest rates. Not the Fed in short-term. The Federal Reserve can only influence short-term rates. It has no control over long-term rates. And long-term rates have been rising steadily for over a year now. Long-term U.S. interest rates. And that's been driving up the dollar. The dollar has risen to, in relationship to a basket of goods, by over 20%. Just 11% since the beginning of this month. So the dollar is rising because long-term rates are rising. And if the dollar and rates are rising, then the price of oil is going to decline. Overlaid on that, of course, are real reasons why the price of oil is declining, and that is slowdown in China. China purchased 48% of all the global oil, and if it's slowing down, guess what? You got an oversupply. And then you got the Saudis, who picked the fight with the U.S. oil and gas frackers, because they knew it was the beginning of the end. Once the U.S. became self-sufficient in oil, which it is now, in fact, it's now it's become an exporter of oil, and soon an exporter of natural gas, big time, which, by the way, will raise prices of natural gas here in the U.S. So, you know, the U.S. is self-sufficient now, and the Saudis knew that, so they're trying to pick a fight before it became too late for them, and they increased the output. Even though the global economy was slowing down, China in particular, they increased the production of oil. Well, the rest of the oil-producing countries around the world, particularly countries like Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Indonesia, etc., Colombia, you know, Brazil even, Mexico, Canada. Well, the price of oil is falling. You would think that they would get together and say, well, let's control the price by reducing production. But they've done just the opposite, you see, because these countries are largely dependent upon revenue, the government revenue, from oil sales. These are national oil companies, you know, whether you're Russia or Nigeria or Venezuela or whatever. And like in Venezuela, 97% of all government revenues are based on oil sales. That's why there's such a crisis in Venezuela. The government's running out of money from oil sales. It's not the government's fault. It's the global economy. They're being squeezed. So is Russia, Nigeria, all of them. It's not that the policies of the government are so wrong in Venezuela. Certainly not wrong as far as the people are concerned. Everyone's for the first time, you know, since Chavez, have benefited in any way from the wealth of oil in that country. But the oil price collapse is devastating all the programs and policies in Venezuela, as it is in Nigeria and everywhere else where oil has collapsed from $120 to $30. Okay, so, you know, you would think that, okay, they would do something to get the price of oil up, but the Saudis don't want to. The Saudis want to drive these competitors, including the oil frackers in the U.S., out of business, so they keep it flowing. Even though global demand's collapsing, they keep supply growing. And these other countries have to follow suit, because they're so, even if the price is lower, they got to continue production, even increase it, to try to maintain the revenue they need for their national budgets. So that's overlaid on top of this interest rate dollar rise, U.S., and collapse of global oil, because oil is a financial asset, not just a physical commodity. It's both. And you got speculators who drive up the price of that asset and drive it down. and that's overlaid on top of the real forces of supply and demand for oil. The speculators, you know, are an overlay on this whole thing and cause a lot of the short-term volatility in movements. And then we got Iran, into the situation here now, you know, with the deal recently negotiated with the West. So Western companies can jump in Iran and make all kind of money there now, which they're doing, right? Iran has to make money, wants to make money from oil sales. So it's coming on market now, coming on market with huge amounts of oil sales and driving the price even lower. This recent collapse of prices down to about the mid-20s was all the speculators anticipating the flow of excess supply from Iran hitting the market. Okay, and they made their money, and the price has driven up, drifted back up to about $33, $34 a barrel. You know, and it's going to be hovering around there for some time. So we have these real supply and demand forces, you know, Saudi and national government budgets, Iran and so forth, U.S. oil frackers, etc., driving and keeping the price of oil down. But we have the speculators, you know, also realizing there's opportunity here to make short-term capital gains by manipulating oil futures prices. And that's going on at the same time. And, you know, our friends in the economic profession just can't understand why there's a correlation between oil prices and stock market declines. Well, it has to do ultimately with all these factors, but certainly the continued rise of U.S. interest rates, long-term interest rates, and therefore the rise of the U.S. dollar, and therefore the devaluation. As the dollar long-term rates rise, the dollar rises over 20% now. You know, it puts pressure, downward pressure, on currencies of other countries. That's why the yuan, the Chinese yuan, cannot remain in the peg. That's why at some point that peg is going to have to be broken. And when it is broken, it's going to reverberate around the world. There's going to be a big shock. And that could be what sets off the already drift into financial crisis that's going on. Quite possible. We'll just have to see if that happens, or to what extent that happens. I always believe that the crisis, the next one, will not come in the U.S., will come in China, and China will set off the global crisis. That's what's going to happen. And it's the emerging markets, which are most at risk, that are going to have the big problem. Emerging markets. So, originate in China, spill over to emerging markets, and therefore, all the others as well are going to occur. Okay. Now, let's continue. China and emerging markets aren't the only source of potential big problem. There's another problem that's sort of arisen here to the surface in Europe. Non-performing bank loans in Europe. I've reported that it's at least $1.5 trillion of non-performing loans. In other words, loans that are sitting on bank balance sheets, banks have loaned to companies, because we don't have much in the way of capital markets in Europe. We have a lot of traditional bank lending, bank loans. You see, the corporate bond market and junk bond and all these other bond markets aren't as developed in Europe. It's more traditional, especially in Germany. And they're sitting on at least $1.5 trillion of non-performing loans. Non-performing meaning companies who have borrowed from the banks in Europe and can't pay the principal or interest. That's what's called non-performing. Well, the banks, you know, have just kept those loans on their balance sheets, even though the companies aren't paying them back. And, you know, there's $1.5 trillion at least. Well, you know, they came out with a statistic here not too long ago. This is $1.1 trillion for the largest 100 banks in Europe. So there's at least $1.5 trillion. By the way, there's $2.5 trillion in non-performing loans in China. bank loans. You know, but China's got $3 trillion of currency reserves and other measures and programs they can introduce to contain those loans that are non-performing in China. It's called, they're called entrusted loans in China. Loans that have been made by central banks, the central bank in China and other government banks, to these old line industrial companies, you know, steel and cement and so forth, that are essentially bankrupt. But China keeps it going, because if they shut them down, well, then you got tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of workers without jobs, and there's already a lot of ferment going on at the grassroots among workers in China. And China just doesn't want that to explode. So, you know, they're going to have to cover those loans, those bad loans in China. And, you know, they're really zombie companies over there, and being kept afloat, $2.5 trillion. Well, we got zombie companies here in Europe, $1.5 trillion too. And you know what? Most of them are located, well, a big part of them are located in Italy. Italy, what is it, the third, fourth largest economy in Europe? Italy is Italian banks, the top five Italian banks, have $350 billion in non-performing loans. So there's probably at least $400 billion of the $1.5 trillion of non-performing bank loans in Italy alone. So Italy has set up what's called a bad bank. It's a government bank that says, okay, we're going to bail you bankers out. Give us all your bad loans, and we'll put it in this new government-run bad bank. We'll get those bad loans off of your balance sheet so you could start lending again. And, you know, the government will absorb through this quasi-nationalized special bad bank, as they call it, bad bank for bad loans, right? And then, you know, we, the government, will figure out how to sell off these loans as distressed debt or something over a longer period of time. In Scandinavia, they've done this repeatedly a number of times. We actually talked about that in 2009 here in this country, whether to create a bad bank for all the bad loans. But we decided not to do that. We, meaning, you know, Geithner and his buddies, and Bernanke, decided not to do that in the U.S. because the banker said, no, you know, bail us out, make those loans good again, and we'll sell them, and we'll make the profit off of it, you know. No, we don't want to give those to you, government, so you can make the profit off of them when you eventually sell them. Leave them here. Just keep plowing that QE into us, and, you know, we'll offset that black hole of bad loans that we have, U.S. banks, 2009, and let's just wait. You know, things will get better, and we'll make a profit off it again, which is, of course, what they did. That was the U.S. approach, which was even more generous to the bankers than when you set up a bad bank. You see, then it's the loans and the securities belong to the government, and the government sells them off at some point and make some money off of it. It's a form of quasi-nationalization of the banks. But we don't do that in the U.S. We're far more generous to our bankers. Anyway, but they, you know, they've set up a bad bank in Italy. But now talk is that, gee, it's not going to work, you know. It's not really going to refloat the Italian financial system, which is, you know, not as bad as Greece, but not so good. You know, the whole southern periphery in Europe is still awash in bad debt and bad loans, right? And it's not going to do much for the Italian, these five Italian banks, because their stock prices have fallen 30-40% already, which is an indicator that they're in trouble. All right. So that's interesting. You know, To partially sum up, we've got the U.S. GDP here weakening. We got China capital flight. We got currency wars ratcheting up. Japan and the Eurozone driving it at the same time, putting pressure on China and other emerging markets currencies. We got U.S. long-term rates out of the control of the Fed steadily rising, and therefore contributing to the driving down of prices for global oil. And we got Italian banks in trouble. Right. And then we have these corruption and resignations beginning to go on. Another sign of stress, right? In China, the director of the statistics there, Wang Baoan, or something, I hope that's the right pronunciation, B-A-O-A-N, Wang Baoan, the head of China statistics, got caught in the web of anti-corruption. Something's going on there. Oh, he's not reporting the statistics right or something. Yep. We've been saying all along, China stats, not reliable. None of these GDP stats are really reliable. I've talked about it before. It's just the degree of unreliability, you know, and the West is not quite as unreliable. But no one believes that China's growing at 6.8%. No one. You know, China's growing if it's growing at 5%. That's probably the upper end of the accurate growth. Others have put it as low as 3. I think it's somewhere around 4.5, the real GDP growth rate in China. If you look at all the other statistics, electricity and shipping and freight and so forth, there's no way it's growing at 6.8. Okay, but it's slowing down rapidly, and of course, as we said, China consumes 48% of global oil, so it slows down global oil supplies continue to rise, especially when sovereign countries need the revenue and keep the product going in terms of output. Russia has raised some feelers last week as well to say, well, maybe we should get together and do something about restricting output instead of just pumping it in there. But we'll see if the Russians and the Saudis can get along enough to come to some sort of agreement. I doubt it. So, you know, Japan, resignation of Akira Amari for corruption. You know, who is he? You know, he's one of Shinzo Abe, the prime minister's main man here in charge of Japan statistics. Look, if you think these guys in these countries, after 6 years of poor recovery, are not doing something about doctoring the rates and GDP, well, you're naive. You know, it doesn't mean you totally falsify. It means wherever you can, you sort of squeeze the numbers to make them look a little better. And I think that's going on in the U.S. as well, you know. What they do is they come in with the low preliminary GDP numbers, and then they figure out a way in the revisions to up those numbers, you know, technically, big time. Well, even Japan, you know, they had a 2 quarters of negative GDP here in the third quarter. And as I said last week, within a week, you know, unprecedented quick revision, within a week, Japan's third quarter GDP goes from a negative 0.9 to a positive 1.1. Well, there's no way you can have that big of a revision within a week. Right? Someone looked at the numbers and said, what are you doing? You know? Change them. And of course they did. You know? So you got to take these GDP numbers with a grain of salt, which simply means they're always erring to the high side, both, you know, in their adjustments and even in their, well, certainly in their adjustments and their revisions. Okay, so that's what's going on over there. Very important resignations. George Soros, big speculator, global speculator, you know, was interviewed at Davos, the World Economic Forum here. Soros was interviewed by Bloomberg News. Bloomberg interviews all the bigwigs when they go to Davos in every January, right? These are the big capitalists. And what did George Soros say about some of these things? You know, he's the guy that really has a sense of where things are going. He's a big speculator, billionaire, but he's a weird sort of billionaire because he came up from the bottom as an immigrant himself from Eastern Europe, and became a big private equity, not private equity, but hedge fund speculator on currencies. So he understands currencies. You know, he made his billion in speculating currencies in the 90s, and he's been talking about a hard landing in China is unavoidable. Unavoidable, right? The debt, total debt in China is probably 350% of GDP. Well, if GDP is $10 trillion, you know, you're looking at total China debt, $25-30 trillion at least. Well, you know, my book, Financial Fragility, or Systemic Fragility in the Global Economy, just came out this month, estimated that as well for China. We have a growth of total debt since 2010, an additional growth of debt in the global economy of at least $50 trillion, $50 trillion more. You know, debt is the foundation of financial instability, and liquidity is the foundation of the debt. Well, central banks pumping more and more liquidity, creating more and more debt, you know, sovereign government debt, corporate debt, mostly, not that much consumer debt. Consumers increase their debt because they try to maintain their standard of living. But that's the smallest of the three entities of debt. By far the biggest is private corporate debt, and especially financial corporate debt. Most of the total $50 trillion is private debt increase, and most of that has occurred in emerging markets in China. That's why as that debt unwinds, that's where the crisis is going to occur. And, you know, that's what Soros said. He says a hard landing. And he's looking at the deflating prices in financial assets. You know, stock prices are declining. Oil prices are declining. Property prices are declining. And deflation is the bogeyman. Because when prices decline, economic activity, real economic activity, freezes up. It stops, you see. And that's what's happening right now. You know, when prices declining in the oil markets, you know, all the investment and oil and expansion and so forth at all levels is freezing up, collapsing, right? And now it's beginning to drift over the collapse to other real investment, manufacturing and so forth. And eventually, it spills over to services, right? In that sequence, pretty much, right? And as far as deflation, he sees this deflation occurring everywhere. And he says, we don't know how to handle deflation, right? And it's happening. Well, certainly central banks don't know how to handle it. You know, they think they're going to get the prices back up to 2% by pumping even more money into the economy, right? More liquidity. Well, Japan and Europe, right? And that's the way to get prices up. Well, the prices aren't getting up because you don't have real investment occurring. So real goods and services prices aren't rising. They're disinflating. In other words, the air is coming out of the bag, and soon it will deflate. We're almost in deflation in Europe and in Japan already, not to mention emerging markets. So financial assets are deflating. Who wants to invest money in the stock market where the trend is for prices to fall? Who wants to invest money in corporate bonds, you know, where interest rates are rising because it's getting risky to invest in corporations, and therefore the price of bonds are falling, corporate bonds? Who wants to do that? Well, no investor wants to do that. What kind of company wants to expand its production when 6 months from now, when the new product hits the market, the price is going to be lower, and you don't even know how much lower? No, they're not going to do that. They're going to hunker down, right? And that's what why they think negative interest rates will prevent them from hunkering down, will push them, companies, to continue investment. But as I said before, you know, the cost of the negative rates is far less than the cost and the uncertainty of investing and expanding. So it's not going to work. Okay, so deflation in real goods has the effect of real businesses saying, "Oh, it's uncertain what the future profitability will be. I'm not going to invest," right? Because prices are falling, and the same with consumers. The prices are falling; they don't rush in and purchase or increase their purchases. They wait for the price to fall further. You know, a good example we've seen here with this gasoline price decline. It hasn't stimulated more consumption. I mean, you know, you're not going to drive more simply because the prices are less. Yeah, you're going to pay less for prices, but at the same time we've been paying less for gasoline prices, guess what's happening? The price of medical care is rising, education is rising, and other rents are rising. So all that savings from the oil price is being sopped up, absorbed by other rising prices for American consumers. And that's why there's no real net economic effect. Soros points to this deflation problem, and it's not just the deflation in real goods and services, which is happening everywhere, disinflation, but it's also financial asset prices are really deflating. You see, real goods and services prices don't move as volatilely as financial asset prices. And I talk about this relationship between two price systems in my book. Financial asset prices and goods prices, they are different animals. They behave differently in terms of supply and demand. Economists don't understand it. They think all prices are the same, you know. All supply and demand works the same way in all price systems and all goods, whether financial securities or goods and services. Not true. Not true. Financial asset prices behave differently, and they drive goods prices. And that's what's happening. Now we've got the rapid decline in financial asset prices and stock prices, oil futures, commodity futures prices, currencies, which is just the price of money, interest rates, also the price of money, currencies, the price of exchange rate prices. Right? So we see all these financial asset prices now beginning to deflate everywhere. And when that deflation converges, then you're going to see a crack in the global financial system. It hasn't reached there yet, but investors are beginning to look around and say, oh, gee, oil prices declining? Oil commodity futures declining and other assets declining, financial global stocks and so forth, right? And we don't even know what's going on in the derivative side of everything, and they freeze up. You know, right now they're still moving the money around from one financial asset market collapsing to another that they think is not as bad off or is rising a little bit. You know, they're moving their money around, but at some point these things are going to converge, and their expectations are going to be such that they're going to pull the money out of everything. And then all these financial asset prices decline. And when you have financial asset prices decline, you get defaults. And defaults reverberate over to the real side of the economy, because then companies have to sell off their real assets to raise money to pay for the debt that's been incurred through the financial speculation. And we're moving towards that. We're moving towards that. Right? Okay, what else did George say, George Soros? You know, he talked about China and deflation was really big, right? Oh, he said Greece is still a problem for Europe. And overlaid on that now is all this immigration problem. Well, they caused, you know, Europeans deserve it. They caused it. You know, they listened to NATO and the U.S. and they went and they, you know, caused failed states everywhere in the Middle East, Libya, Syria, Iraq, and so forth. Well, and now they're reaping the whirlwind as the folks, you know, in those countries are saying, we're getting out of here, and we're marching into Europe. Well, they caused the problem themselves. Maybe next time they won't listen to NATO and the U.S., which is NATO, okay? Europeans have no foreign policy anymore. They're just an appendage of the U.S. here, all of them, because they're economically dependent on the U.S., right? Anyway, that's another question. But George says there's no way central banks are going to get prices back up to 3%, right? And QE has diminishing returns, which we're seeing in Japan and Europe, and now they're getting more desperate with negative interest rates. You know, central banks have failed, and the next crisis is coming, and they've shot all their ammunition, and they've totally failed. That's the truth that we're looking, staring into the face of. They have no solution, monetary solution anymore, to the creeping crisis that's coming. What's going to happen? It could be a lot worse, some are saying. And we have this election on top of it all, you know, where we have Trump who says he wants to give another $10 trillion in tax cuts. I think it's more than $10 trillion. To investors and businesses, which include himself, by the way. $10 trillion he wants, more tax cuts. We've already given him $10 trillion since George W. Bush. By the way, I'm going to talk about that next week because I'm writing an article on it, how $10 trillion have been given to investors and corporations and bankers, and this is what we got for it, the situation right now. And they're all talking to him in Congress, you know, all those dummies in Congress. Boy, the level of stupidity in Congress, particularly in the House, is immense as far as economics is concerned. And, you know, they're talking about even more tax cuts for the rich. You know, flat taxes, Cruz with his flat tax, and, you know, Trump with his $10 trillion more. That would make $20 trillion versus $2 billion. What do you do? We give these guys $10 trillion every decade? Is that what the whole thing is about now? Is that their solution? They think so. Okay, so next week we didn't get to the Friedrich case about how unions are being devastated even more now. We'll try to talk about that next week. And the $10 trillion they were given and the $10 trillion more that they want. Next week on Alternative Vision, Jack Russell.